Washington.
How shall I describe tonight's orchestra? Last night they sold out a rock club in the heart of London's West End, playing their own version of Vivaldi's Four Seasons, complete with thunder, dogs, dancing, and some impeccable playing. They're the hugely imaginative Norwegian Chamber Orchestra, here tonight at the Proms to infuse us with the spirit of Mozart. There are two of his compositions, a symphony and a piano concerto, and Mozart's also present in a new piece by the Danish composer Bent Sørensen, La Mattina, receiving its UK premiere. And how could we bring the Norwegians here and not hear Grieg? His elegant Holberg Suite begins part two of the Prom. It's Mozart's Haffner Symphony which begins the concert. You can imagine Mozart's irritation when, just as he's up to his eyes in his early months in Vienna working on his opera Die Entführung, he gets a letter from his father asking for a new symphony to celebrate the ennoblement of a family friend, Sigmund Haffner, just when he thought he was away from his father's clutches. Somehow, though, Mozart managed to get the symphony written and he sent it back to Salzburg in instalments. How that must have irritated Leopold Mozart. And he put a little note in the final package. I hope that this will reach you in good time and be to your taste. Well, a few months later, Mozart needed a new symphony for Vienna, so he asked his father to send the manuscript back. It was only when he looked at the score again that he realised just how good it was. "It's positively amazed me," he wrote, "for I'd forgotten every single note of it." He altered the opening, taking away the ceremonial march needed for Herr Haffner's ceremony, and he shaped it into the four-movement symphony which we know today. Well, you can hear the applause here from the Royal Albert Hall, the Norwegian Chamber Orchestra coming onto the stage. There's no conductor as such. They're directed by their leader and their joint artistic director, Isabel van Keulen. Last few players just making their way onto the stage. They're all in place now, ready to begin tonight's concert with Mozart Symphony No. 35, the Haffner Symphony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Norwegian Chamber Orchestra are beginning their prom tonight here at the Royal Albert Hall with Mozart's Haffner Symphony, his Symphony No. 35 in DK385. Directed by the leader and one of the orchestra's artistic directors, Isabel von Koerlen. Mozart wrote the symphony at his father's request for an ennoblement ceremony for a family friend called Sigmund Haffner, hence the title. Having let the score out of his sight for a few months, Mozart was delighted when he got it back and realized just how good it was. He programmed it for a concert at the Burgtheater in Vienna. That was in March 1783, when it must have impressed the audience with its arresting opening. And in that audience at the time was the Emperor Joseph II. Isabel von Koerlen is the joint artistic director of the orchestra with the violinist Terje Tønnesen, who founded the orchestra in 1977, who gave such an incredible performance of Vivaldi's Four Seasons at the 100 Club last night. Well, next tonight, the orchestra is going to give the UK premiere of a piece, a piano concerto called La Mattina by the Danish composer Bent Sørensen, the ideas for which came to him when he was listening to the pianist Leif Ove Andsnes and tonight's orchestra playing Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 17 in Vienna. Well, we need a few minutes just to rearrange the stage and get the piano into position, so there's time to hear from Bent Sørensen about how the piece came into being.
Well, I think all the time when you do a piece, you have different sources from different inspiration. And then the whole idea is that all those different sources should meld together and become one kind of inspiration. The very first inspiration was when I was in Vienna together with Leif Ove, and he has been playing my piano piece, The Shadows of Silence. And afterwards, we went to a very famous piano bar called Broadway, which unfortunately is not there anymore. I think it's closed down, but that's a place where all the musicians who has been playing at the Konzerthaus, the Musikverein, etc., comes, and jazz musicians, everyone comes there. And then they're playing the music, and Leif Ove was playing Busoni, Bach Choral. And I just had the feeling that the music was rising from the bottom. And when we walked out of there very, very early in the morning, because the night has gone together, I had the feeling that that was sort of the start of the piano concerto, which we had been talking about for a long time. And I don't use that Bach chorale. Some people think I use that Bach chorale, but I don't. I use fragments of another Bach chorale just to give the imitation. And that's how the piece start. And then it start with another inspiration from a completely other place. We also had to do that because half a year later, when Leif Ove played this piece in Bergen, there was a hearing aid, and you had that very, very high pitch all over the place. And then I said, well, it's irritating, but I steal it. And that's why on the top of this low piano, you hear very, very softly, like a bird, this thing's going on. Also, a lot of other sources. There is, you could say, the fourth movement is the piano and the orchestra never together. They never play together. It's like two people who are touching each other with their dreams, and they don't touch each other. It's like a very innocent love affair between two people who don't touch each other. And the only way they touch each other is when the orchestra is humming. And then at a certain time, they start to meld together. And then there is one thing in it, a particular idea, which is coming in the end of this third movement and the very end of the piece, is that like the piano is dancing out of the orchestra and becomes very much alone. The first time, he has a lot of clavis, which is two pieces of wood plate against each other, who is following him. But in the end, he becomes very much on his own. It is actually like two people, because it's always traveling around A and G sharp. The inspiration was actually a walk I had with a friend of mine who was walking about. We was very excited about talking about something, and then she was walking about 20 centimeters or half a meter in front of me all the time. So we had this feeling of discussing music and things like that. And I thought that is kind of like interesting inspiration. And then that's also a kind of morning thing. And then it's like the whole journey of being asleep and get up.
Bent Sørensen talking to me earlier on today. And now here come Leif Ove Andsnes and Isabel von Koerlen with Per Christian Skjoldstad, who's going to conduct the performance of Bent Sørensen's La Mattina, the UK premiere. The UK premiere of Bent Sorensen's piece La Mattina, played here at the Proms by the pianist Leif Ove Andsnes, with the Norwegian Chamber Orchestra conducted by Per Christian Skalstad. And there's more from Leif Ove later on tonight in the Prom, Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 24. And applause too for the composer Bent Sorensen just making his way onto the stage. He's collaborated with Leif Ove on a number of occasions. The last time we heard his music here at the Proms was actually in 2005, a memorable piece based on Hans Christian Andersen's tale of the Little Mermaid, and we actually had a chorus of mermaids down in the arena with the promenaders. The conductor, Per Christian Skalstad, usually plays violin in the orchestra, but he's a freelance conductor with a number of orchestras in Norway. Leif Ove Andsnes was earlier on telling me about what it's like to get a new piece from Bent Sorensen. He said when you first get the score, it looks really hard to play and it feels like a Bach four-part invention with offbeats in unusual places. He says Bent Sorensen's music is so organic and flowing. And what he loves about this particular piece, La Mattina, he says, is the dreamlike landscape, and he feels quite haunted by it. Bent Sorensen was saying to me earlier on today that he thought that this was probably the best concert hall in the world for really soft music, and there were some unbelievably soft passages. And during the rehearsals this morning, we were moving around in different parts of the hall and listening to it, and it really felt like some of those really thin filigree sounds were just floating above us or coming from behind us. Per Christian, the conductor, was also saying that unanimously the orchestra absolutely loved to play it, find it very fulfilling, and of course they enjoyed their doubling parts on claves as well, adding another dimension. Well, as I mentioned earlier on, the Norwegian Chamber Orchestra played Vivaldi's Four Seasons at London's 100 Club last night in London's West End. During our Proms Plus event at the Royal College of Music earlier on this evening, I spoke with them about that and other things, speaking to Isabel van Koenen, Bent Sorensen, and the founder and artistic director of the orchestra, Terje Tønnesen. Terje Tønnesen, you've sold out a rock venue in London and the Royal Albert Hall tonight. Tell me a little bit about why you played Vivaldi as you do.
It started 10 years ago, maybe. I got another engagement playing the Vivaldi Seasons, and that has been played by many others and myself many times before. And so I thought, why? And then after a little thought, I thought that what is important is maybe to retell the story, or to bring the storytelling back. Then we created this new version out from this fact.
I think you can only really bring something like that off if you have a very particular body of people who are playing it, a great sense of commitment amongst the performers. And Isabel, perhaps I can bring you in here as well. The performers you have in the Norwegian Chamber Orchestra, I think, are rather special people.
Yes, they're incredibly committed, and they're people that really want to do it. I mean, it's not an ordinary ensemble that you have a job in an orchestra, but they do it because they want to play, and most of them have jobs in other orchestras, and they just fill their free time with rehearsing the Norwegian Chamber Orchestra. So there's an awful lot of dedication, and you have rehearsal days where we rehearse 5-6 hours, and people are just getting on to the opera for another 5-hour rehearsal. So and nobody is complaining. So, and I think in the performance you hear that dedication.
Terje, this was very much your project as a founder of the Norwegian Chamber Orchestra. How has it developed over the years?
Well, it's 30 years, so it's a long time with a lot of faces. So it's a very difficult question to answer. We also used to have Iona Brown with us for many years. And so she and I, we cooperated for many years. Then the orchestra learned very much the English style of playing in orchestra, which at that time was sort of that the style everybody wanted to learn with the academy and their years. Then when she left, then you can say we got more extreme. We have a sort of say that we want to stay with the tradition and develop that, but we also want to look at music in another angle, to confront the tradition. So it's a little sort of paradoxical attitude we have now.
And how does this attitude go down in Norway?
I think Norway is a place that it hasn't got a cultural history like many other countries. It's sport-wise we have a history, but not cultural. So there is quite a big amount of open-mindedness. Maybe in bigger centres this would have been, that has a strong sense of tradition and culture, this, or a lot of the things we have done would have been more difficult.
You've brought a Danish composer with you for this prom. May I bring you in, Bent Sørensen? And we're going to have the UK premiere of your piece La Mattina this evening. Perhaps you could give us a little bit of an introduction to it and how it came about in the first place.
I worked with Leif Ove with another piece, a solo piece called The Shadows of Silence, and then we decided to do a piano concerto. Morning is a sort of a starting point for, I mean, you can say that every morning you can wake up and say, this is the first morning in the rest of my life. And so it's also a kind of life story in a way. I think there's a journey of a life in it, because it goes out to some much lighter periods of time. It's like people who are running beside each other or something. And the pianist and the orchestra is sort of like two persons who are having a relationship. That's how I hear it. I always see music as when you have a pianist and an orchestra, and even the individuals in the orchestra, I start to think them as human beings. Not the musicians so much, but more their instruments. I mean, the musicians as well, of course, but more the sort of the feeling of that there is a story there. And music is such a wonderful art form to tell stories in, because nobody can control if it's wrong or right. And you don't have to kill anyone, or you don't have to make it excited another way. You just have to write something which is emotional. And the whole piece ends up with that this pianist or this piano or maybe one or two persons who is melded together in the concerto, they run away to somewhere, and the orchestra is disappearing until the very ending, where it gradually carries the head of the pianist. So it's a happy ending in a way. So that is, and then of course it's a Mozart orchestra. That was one of the ideas I had from the beginning. But of course, when we talked about the concerto, I said, why don't we make one for the Mozart orchestra? So it's built at the same orchestration as Mozart number 17, which is my favorite piano concerto. And in that concerto too, there's a lot of breaks. The second movement of the number 17, if you listen to that, there is some fantastic pauses, which is very, very difficult to play, because they are magic in itself. And if you make them too long, they disappear, the magic disappears. If you make them too short, the magic disappears. And in my case, when there's a lot of those small breaks in the piece, suddenly there is a little pause, there's nothing going on. And then you can, yeah, that's it.
It was really interesting listening to the piece during rehearsals this morning in the hall, because a lot of the music is very, very quiet. You might grasp a little filigree phrase from somewhere, but I think we both felt that there were notes floating above us, coming from behind us. Playing it in this acoustic was really quite special.
Yeah, I think, I mean, this piece was sort of, I wrote this, the music from before, I always see my pieces as, You know, you start something and then you're following something and then you go on to something else after a while. And this is sort of a starting point. It was a new piece for me. And it was like, I wrote it during 2 years, and at the same time I wrote a very sad piece called Sounds Like You, which is a sort of hopeless love story, a theater play taking place in a concert hall. And I think that is very much it's the opposite picture. I felt this wasn't. I know it's dark, and and I've read some places it's my darkest piece, but it's also my most playful piece. It's more written by a teenager than a lot of the other pieces I've done when I was a teenager. And that time when this piece was done, what I'm working on now is very much to do with rooms, because, I mean, the piece Sounds Like You, as mentioned, is taking place in the concert hall, and I'm working very much with rooms. And I also feel that this piece has a spatial dimension, because there's so many things where when you hum a note with closed mouth together with a piano, then there comes a kind of deep perspective. So the sound suddenly goes somewhere else. And I think particularly in the beginning, when the violins are having this enormously long F sharp, who's sometimes become an E, on top of the piano, it sometimes sounds that it's moving around in the hall. And I think the Royal Albert Hall is such a beautiful hall. It's a beautiful hall, but it's also a beautiful hall for soft music. You can hear everything everywhere, but you can hear it differently. And that means that it's a fantastic venue, because wherever you stand, wherever you sit, it's only you who get this experience. And I think we're so much used to put a CD in a CD player and then sit down and listen to everything. We listen to the same, we're seeing the same. And then you can actually, with music, of course, we never know. I never know what you hear. I mean, that's the magic about music. We can talk about it, but we don't know what we've been hearing. In this hall, it's really individual.
Terje and Isabel, both as violinists, you both had the opportunities of playing this piece. What's it like to play?
Well, it's damn hard to hum and play at the same time. And then you've got these claves and do that as well. I mean, it's all very complicated, but it pays off. And it's, it sounds ridiculous, it's great fun, but it's wonderful to follow that shape and follow the atmosphere and be part of it. But it's a tricky piece.
Isabel, you're leading it tonight, but Terje, you've been part of it in the past.
Yes, and the experience being a musician, and especially in a piece like this, is a little stronger than what you expressed before, that you are geographically on one place, so you see everything from this part. So I had the opportunity to hear this piece when it was first performed. And in a way, that was a greater experience, because then I can have it all. Mm-hmm. By playing, then you just get your personal part and your surroundings from a particular angle.
We keep sort of talking about, and the pianist tonight is, of course, Leif Ove Andsnes, and there isn't anyone I've spoken to today who hasn't had the most glowing things to say about him. He brings so much to the music and has a very special relationship with the orchestra.
Yes, he's been our guest leader for quite some years. So he has meant a lot to the orchestra, both as inspirator and also getting the orchestra out of Norway.
There aren't too many pianists who would have been happy after your performance of the Four Seasons at the 100 Club last night to then go on in T-shirt and jeans and say, I'll just play four Chopin waltzes. And then that was followed by two movements from the Brahms G minor quartet as well. So he's very special in personality as well as what he brings to the music. And he was also saying to me this morning about when he saw the score for La Mattina for the first time, how he's struck by its difficulty. And then it opens up into this dreamlike landscape. So the relationship between you and him has been vital in developing just what you wanted to achieve, Bent Sørensen.
Yes, definitely. I think it's for me, I think it's very important when you work with, It's difficult to write a piano concerto and sing, but who can play it afterwards? I mean, it's a gift to work with Leif Ove because he's just an amazing musician and because he's so devoted to the music and to create, to try to find the spirit, not only to find the spirit I want to express, but sort of saying to himself, I want to have that feeling. And I think that's when you become a great, great musician. It's not only to say I'm trying to do what the composer wants, but I'm actually want to try to be the composer. I mean, I always think that, and that's not only Leif Ove, it's also the Norwegian Chamber Orchestra. Now I can say something nice to them, because it's very few orchestras where you actually feel that you have a feeling that everyone is a part of the same body. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not only me. And then Isabella Terry, who's leading, and then Leif Ove playing the piano. It's everyone who's sort of saying, we are together, we are doing this. And even as a composer, it's very difficult to feel that you become a member of creating something. And I think that has also to do with the fact that when music is created, and it doesn't matter if it's me or if it's Mozart or Chopin or Grieg or who else it is, there is a moment where the composer gets the thought, the idea, the feeling, the music in his head, and then he goes down to the pencil, his hand, he goes down to the paper, and then the musician come take the paper, go to his hands or voices, and go to his mind, and then it comes out as music. And if you have the feeling that the link is very, very short, that you actually have the feeling that when a violin player is taking the bow to the string or a pianist is putting the fingers, that is the same movement as when I put it on paper, then you are happy. And I think that's experienced both with Leif Ove and the orchestra.
One of the pieces this evening, there will be no paper in front of you. Grieg's Holberg Suite is so much ingrained in your national soul that the orchestra plays it from memory and standing up. It's a very, very rich experience listening to it this morning. What does Grieg mean to you? How many hours have you got?
Well, it's of course one of our national pieces, so it's very nice for us to play it, especially abroad. And it's a piece that you, in its simpleness, it's a piece that you, sorry, that you don't easily get tired of. So you can play it up and up again, and it's still has its values. He's a very open, emotional composer, Grieg, we find.
The Norwegian Chamber Orchestra has got a particular version of the Holberg Suite, which I'm very sorry to say we're not going to see in its entirety tonight, but you have a particular version which you commissioned a choreographer.
Yes, we... I've been occupied with the energy and how classic musicians turn out for an audience, and especially a classic orchestra seems very sort of shut out of what's happening, of the whole thing. It's not like in a theater where the actors play directly to the audience. And an orchestra tends to look sort of closed, and the music has a lot to do with it. The conductor with his back to the audience and the musician all glooming at the music they have in front of them. Something is missing. And then we experimented first with playing this piece by heart. And suddenly there was an enormous amount of energy. And in the beginning we didn't know what to do with this energy, so then we got a choreographer to make us use up the rest amount. So we danced and played the piece together, and it actually worked.
So all the musicians were dancing and playing at the same time. Next time you come to the proms, you have to do this. Isabel, as a non-Norwegian playing Grieg, but playing it with a lot of Norwegians, does it have a different feel for you?
Well, it made me nervous in the beginning because I thought they must know better. But I have always said that Russian music is not just for Russians, and it's rubbish that, you know, Dutch musicians can play Dutch music very well. So luckily music is so international, so universal, that goes over the borders. And but saying this third movement, you can feel, I think, the and there are a couple of fiddlers in the orchestra, violinists, that do play the Norwegian folk music. So there is definitely something to it. But I would say, in the fourth movement, the air, it doesn't really matter whether you're from China or Holland.
The Mozart piano concerto in the second half of the concert, Leif Uwe directs from the keyboard, so he'll have his back to the audience, and it looks rather as if he's sort of driving a car in the middle of the players. And he was talking about the challenges of being the conductor and the pianist within that. How is it for you, knowing that he's got a lot of pressures on him as soloist?
But we help an awful lot. I mean, obviously, it's more leading than, you know, he hasn't got an extra responsibility because everybody knows exactly what is going on. And, of course, rehearsals, but also what we just spoke about, the commitment helps very much to really keep it together and to get the energy, you know, take away a little bit of pressure from him and get it out to the audience. So I think it works wonderfully well. Without conductor. And anyway, I don't want to say anything negative about conductors, but to have the experience in general with this orchestra to play without conductor, again, it's like playing by heart. It's one factor that can distract less. So there's more chance for energy or for something very special to happen. And people listen more carefully, musicians listen more carefully, and there is more space for input as well from the musicians.
Our perception here in the UK of the Norwegian music scene is that it's a hotbed of talent and there's constant creativity going on. Is this true?
Yes.
Terje?
Yes, it's maybe the sport factor and the good money that's done a lot. Also Grand Prix now. Now you can't get a sort of small fiddle for kids anymore because they're all sold out. Because we won Grand Prix last year.
The Alexander Rybak effect.
They all want
effect.
To play, yeah. Yeah.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, it's a good thing, in a way.
Where would you like things to go with the Norwegian Chamber Orchestra? What ambitions do you have for it?
I would like it to develop itself as an important institution of classic music in Norway and abroad. This is very general. It sounds, you know, it's saying like nothing, but it's hard to specify that. I think in our way we want to keep tradition and develop the tradition. And on the other side, the paradoxical side is then to attack the tradition, and then to create fertilizer for new ways to look upon the history.
I've no doubt that the orchestra will continue to create a history of its own, bearing in mind everything we've heard over the last couple of days from them. I was talking to Terje Tønnesen, Isabel van Keulen and the composer Bent Sørensen earlier on at the Royal College of Music. And welcome back from me, Fiona Talkington, to the Royal Albert Hall, where the Norwegian Chamber Orchestra is just preparing the ground for part two of tonight's prom. Leif Uwe Andsnes will be soloist and director of the orchestra in Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 24. But before that, they're on home territory, playing Grieg, his Holberg Suite, or to give it its correct title, From Holberg's Time, Suite in the Olden Style. Ludvig Holberg was a Norwegian playwright and philosopher who was born in Bergen, Grieg's own home city, in 1684. 200 years later, a committee was formed to coordinate some bicentenary celebrations, and Grieg, who was an eminent composer with his piano concerto and the music for Peer Gynt behind him, was asked to write a piece. In fact, he was asked to write a cantata to be sung outdoors during the unveiling of a statue in the main square in Bergen. What Grieg actually completed, though, was a five-movement piano suite, which he later orchestrated using French Baroque dance forms, a sarabande, a gavotte, an air, and a final rigodon. Well, there are only chairs for the cellists on the stage. The rest of the orchestra is going to be a band playing right at the front of the stage, standing up and from memory. Grieg's Holberg Suite.
Thank you.
Holberg Suites, Suite in the Olden Style, in a memorable performance here at the Proms. The Norwegian Chamber Orchestra, directed by Isabel van Perlen, standing right at the front of the stage and performing it from memory. And as the artistic director and founder, Terje Tønnesen, was telling us earlier on, they do another version of this piece. They've worked with a choreographer who taught them the dances to go with the music, and the performances they've given while dancing have been hugely successful. And even this morning in rehearsals here at the Royal Albert Hall, some of the players were saying, we want to do it with the dancing. And actually, you could probably hear there was just a little bit of dancing going on, a little bit of foot tapping and heel clicking in true Norwegian style. Well, this is Grieg inspired by old French dance forms, but he does bring in some very Norwegian sounding dance rhythms too. And there are some hardanger fiddle players in the orchestra who I think were particularly relishing those, the hardanger fiddle, the traditional string instrument of Norway. And I think a performance much enjoyed by the promenaders as well. I bet they would have liked to have danced. Isabel van Perlen, joint artistic director and leader of the orchestra, directing them then. A performance of the Holberg Suite. Coming back on and saying, you can't sit here all night and listen to the applause. We've got to clear the platform, put some chairs back on and get it ready for another piece. But one more bow from the players. Well, the piece we're going to hear next of all is Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 24, performed by Leif Ove Andsnes with the orchestra. I spoke to him earlier on during rehearsals and asked him just what's so special about Mozart Piano Concertos.
Well, I'm just so lucky to play this instrument, which has so much wonderful music, but Mozart Piano Concertos are just every piece, at least the last 20, are just wonderful, wonderful pieces, and each of them are so different, and they are... Some of them, like the one we're playing tonight, it's like a mini opera in a way. It's so dramatic. It's so full of theater and life and different voices popping up. It's just the world into itself and very contrasting movements. The first movement is so compact. One can see why this was Beethoven's favorite music, you know, because he uses this motive that he's building the whole movement on, which is not so often for him to do. And Beethoven would continue that line, of course. And then a very contrasting, lovely second movement, very innocent. And then the last movement is just about the best variation piece he ever wrote. And that says a lot because he wrote quite a few of them.
You direct the concerto from the keyboard. What are the challenges for you for doing that?
The challenges I find are often when I start a project like this, I tend to concentrate a lot on the orchestra rehearsal, of course. And then the piano playing might suffer for a couple of days. And then I'm thinking, you know, before the concert, okay, now I have to pull myself together. I have to concentrate on the fine piano playing again and the small movements and so on. So that can be a challenge, that you're using different muscles for conducting and waving your arms. And then the next moment you are doing the fine finger work at the keyboard. But the advantages are also great, because I find that I'm so in the middle of the music all the time. You know, when you play with the conductor, you might sit there and wait for the next passage. And this waiting time is sometimes uncomfortable and not very natural in this music, because this music is so flowing and everything is so interwined. And I'm accompanying the wind players and sometimes the strings, and then I have a solo, and it's all one thing. And then to sit on the side is a little bit unnatural. In the setup now, I'm sitting in the middle of the orchestra with the back to the audience. But with facing the musicians, and we have direct eye contact, and they hear me very well, I hear them very well. And that's important in this music, I think.
But of course, you've got a very special relationship with this orchestra, developed over quite a long time.
Yeah, I find that our performances now are built on trust, that we know each other so well, and we can take chances, and we can make every project special. Because we don't play so often together, but I've done a couple of projects each year with this orchestra, including then maybe a tour, so we've spent a couple of weeks together each time, and that's been just wonderful over the years to develop this, and especially with Mozart, we have done a new concerto each season, and so on. Really special journey.
The pianist Leif Ove Andsnes talking to me earlier on, and here he is now coming onto the stage here at the Royal Albert Hall with Isabel van Curlen to perform Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 24 in C minor, K491.
Thank you.
Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 24 in C minor, K491, performed here at the BBC Proms by the Norwegian Chamber Orchestra, led by Isabel van Keulen, and directed from the piano by the pianist Leif Ove Andsnes. The piano is situated so the keyboard is facing the audience, Leif Ove sitting with his back to the promenaders. Right in the heart of the players, the violins on either side of him. Hugely popular performer, just returning to the stage to thank the orchestra. And I'm sure his name on the programme has contributed quite a lot to this prom being sold out. This particular concerto comes from the spring of 1786, when Mozart had become well known for writing concertos for himself to perform at the subscription concerts in Vienna. That spring, he'd begun work on his opera, The Marriage of Figaro, as well as a shorter opera, Der Schauspieldirektor, and Domineo from 6 years earlier on was being revived, so he was busy making some revisions and changes to that. Well, somehow, in the midst of all that hard work, he wrote this piano concerto, often dark yet very powerful music. Leif Ove just bringing the wind players to the front, and the rest of the orchestra too. This is the man who last night was in jeans and t-shirt at a rock club in the heart of London. And halfway through the evening, he got up, talked a little bit about Chopin, the bicentenary, and played 4 Chopin waltzes. Well, that went down very well. So he was then joined by 3 members of the Norwegian Chamber Orchestra, and they played 2 movements of Brahms's G minor piano quartet. The orchestra carrying on to Hamburg tomorrow, an early flight for them, so probably no rock clubs tonight, but I don't know. Leif Ove just returned to the stage once again. I sense there might be a little more music in the air. It's a piece which makes people smile, is what Leif Urbansnes said to me earlier on when we were talking about possible encores. The third movement from Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 14 as an encore from the Norwegian Chamber Orchestra, Leif Urbansnes directing them from the keyboard. He said that movement's such fun to play, it's almost jazzy at times. And that's all from the Norwegian Chamber Orchestra for this time, led by Isabel van Keulen, their joint artistic director, with Terje Tønnesen, and Per Christian Skalstad was the conductor in the new piece by Bent Sørensen. There are two treats at the Proms tomorrow night: the BBC Symphony Orchestra playing Sibelius, Samuel Barber, and a new piece by Mark Anthony Turnage, and then later on tomorrow night, it's Jamie Cullum. But that's all from the Royal Albert Hall for tonight. I'll return you to Broadcasting House and Ian Skelly.
Fiona, thank you very much indeed. Tremendous stuff. That was Fiona Talkington with tonight's Prom at the Royal Albert Hall. No late night clubs for her either, I suspect. She's back later tonight here on Radio 3, introducing performances just as thrilling and diverse by Bessie Smith and Asta Owaike as part of the lineup in tonight's Late Junction. That's at 11:15 here on BBC Radio 3. Before it, we consider the virtual shadow of Samuel Johnson, with a look at how Samuel Johnson's legacy as the creator of the first great dictionary of English has been developed on the other side of the world in Australia. Johnson Now, His Virtual Shadow, is our essay at 11. And before all that, we're going to head for the movies in just over 5 minutes' time in Moscow to meet the heirs of Eisenstein and Tarkovsky. Movie Nights in Moscow is our feature. It begins at 10.
The Proms on BBC Radio 3. Now, anyone who doesn't know the world of Bruckner symphonies would do well to listen to the Minnesota Orchestra Proms, when they can hear Bruckner's Fourth Symphony, The Romantic, one of his most approachable works, and a wonderful symphony in itself, and that will be conducted by Osmo Venska. Also, Shostakovich's first cello concerto, a very dramatic piece, which will be played by Eliza Weilerstein, and Barber's music for a scene from Shelley, a typical example of Barber's wonderful way with orchestral writing. Join me, Rob Cowan, as the BBC Proms continue on Friday at 7:30 here on Radio 3.
Well, back to tonight. It's just coming up to 7 minutes to 10, so there's a little time to go before our feature on the changes in cinema in Russia that reflect the changing face of Russia itself. So I thought we could have some Bruckner next tonight on Radio 3. No time for any of his symphonies, of course, but if you're a singer, then maybe you've enjoyed singing one of his lesser-known but very beautiful motets. He was a man of deep faith, of course. He was the organist at the Augustine Foundation of St. Florian and then at Linz Cathedral. But by the time he composed this motet, Bruckner had become professor of organ, music theory and counterpoint at the Vienna Conservatoire. This is Christus Factus Est, and it's sung here by the choir of the Chapelle Royale in Paris and members of Collegium Vocale, directed by Philippe Herrivega.
Thank you.
Christ, for our sake, was found obedient to death. Christus Factus Est, the motet setting by Anton Bruckner, first performed in the Cathedral Square at Linz in 1869, sung there by the choir of the Chapelle Royale and members of Collegium Vocale, directed by Philippe Herefiger. Well, now, before we head to study the silver screens of Moscow, a word about tomorrow morning from Sarah Morpeach.
On Breakfast, each morning through the summer proms season, we'll be bringing you the Henry Wood Proms Novelties, pieces of music that Sir Henry Wood introduced to proms audiences for the very first time, going right the way back to the first season in 1895. There are lost gems and works that have become great classics over time. The Henry Wood Novelties, in Breakfast on Radio 3, every morning from 7.
Yes, it's surprising how many remarkably familiar tunes and melodies have been introduced to the proms over the years. This is BBC Radio 3. We're broadcasting between 90 and 93 FM and on digital radio and online. The time now is 10 o'clock. And now, movie nights in Moscow. On screen are snowbound landscapes, Soviet-era teddy boys and sci-fi wizardry as Rana Mitter explores new Russian cinema and the new Russia.
When I was a teenager in the 1980s, I saw a new generation of Russian films that truly amazed me. Films such as Come and See and Repentance, which seemed to be asking amazing questions about a political system that was changing beyond recognition. And then, rather like Russia itself, the Russian film industry seemed to go into a decline. It seemed to disappear. Only in the last few years has Russian cinema seemed to revive, producing exciting new pictures from young and inspiring new directors. That's why I've come here to Moscow, where I'm currently standing in the lobby of the October Cinema.
From 2000 to 2008, over those 8 years, you see Russia rising like a phoenix from the ashes to a situation where Russia is among the major film distributors in the world. Major distribution companies invested in the building of multiplexes because they realized that by building proper cinemas, you could actually attract an audience.
Music from Sergei Bodrov's film Mongol, which took Genghis Khan's Central Asian heritage and spun him as a proto-Russian hero. On screen, Genghis Khan gallops thousands of miles in his quest to conquer the world. And cinema in Russia has also been hurtling down a perilous route full of unexpected twists and turns. I want to find out what's happening on screen in Russia today. Recent films touch on everything from villagers to vampires, and the heirs of Eisenstein and Tarkovsky have new visions of post-Soviet Russia that they're keen to project. To understand the story of today's Russian cinema, we need to rewind the reel over 20 years.
When I saw it, I couldn't speak for a few minutes, and that was a general reaction because there was silence normally after the film would end, and then sometimes people would start crying and all that. So we couldn't believe it because that really meant that times are changing.
In 1987, Andrei Ostalsky, who was then a journalist for the major newspaper Izvestia, was in a cinema called Rossiya, watching a Georgian film that transformed not only Russian cinema, but the country itself. Tengiz Abuladze's film, Repentance.
For the first time ever, in an allegoric way, it speaks definitely and clearly about Stalinism and what it has done to the Soviet, Russian, Georgian, whatever people, about this terrible humiliation and the need for repentance for everybody. And what was most shocking was that the authorities allowed this message to be said so loud and clear.
In the Soviet Union, this was the era of perestroika, reconstruction, and glasnost, openness. Earlier copies of Repentance had been confiscated by the KGB. But when the politician Eduard Shevardnadze championed the film, plans to distribute it were debated by the Politburo.
They couldn't decide. Gorbachev was terribly hesitant. He couldn't make up his mind. And then Yakovlev, who was an ally of Shevardnadze and the driving force behind the glasnost, he said, well, let's have a compromise. Let's do two or three copies and show it, you know, in a very limited way and see what the reaction would be. And Gorbachev, who always liked compromises and half measures, he said, let's do this. But then Yakovlev deceived him and allowed 500 copies to be produced and shown around Russia. And then it was shown in very early 1987, and immediately they released the first 140 political prisoners jailed for the so-called anti-Soviet propaganda. How can you keep people in jail for doing something which is now in the film, which is shown in every cinema house? That was, if ever there was an experience of a revolution in art which will bring a political revolution, that was it.
Other landmark films of the Glasnost era included Little Vera, which lifted the lid on domestic abuse, and Plumbum, about a young communist who denounces his own father. But the cinemas went dark at the same time that the USSR, the country that spawned these films, disappeared off the map at the end of 1991. The film critic and academic Birgit Boymers is at Bristol University.
The interest in cinema waned for two reasons. Glasnost and Perestroika had fulfilled their tasks of promoting the changes, political, economic, social, through the medium of culture. A more democratic pattern had been established, which made debates in Parliament, for example, much more interesting to watch than to go into the cinema or the theatre.
So people were watching parliamentary debates on television rather than actually going out to the cinema.
Exactly. And you can see at the beginning of the 90s a sharp drop both in theatre and cinema visits.
As cinemas sprang leaks and screens gathered dust, movie nights in Moscow ended up being endured rather than enjoyed. When the economy went on a rollercoaster ride, the Dom Khanjonkova cinema, the oldest in Russia, was just one of those that fell into disrepair.
I wanted to see this new Russian film, which went on for 2.5 hours, and went to the cinema to buy a ticket, which cost $10, which was a fortune at the time. There were three other people who had purchased a ticket for the screening that I wanted to attend, and that what we found there was an auditorium which could have seated 800 people, where every other seat was broken, which was unheated. Outside, we had temperatures of minus 25. We had a projectionist who a couple of times lost the reels, missed the pauses, missed the prompts. You know, it was impossible.
You might call it cinemasochism. I mean, really, you have to suffer for art in this particular case.
Yes, indeed, yes. But I think it went hand in hand with a growing video market and piracy.
Moscow has the worst traffic jams I've been in the world. And so it's a great relief, quite late at night now, to be speeding through the city. Film in Russia is many things, but it's definitely become commercial. It's definitely become a business. And that's in tenor with the times. I mean, everywhere across the river you see neon signs lit up advertising the businesses that seem to drive Russia today. The Petrocommerce Bank, Gazprom. Russia's economy reached rock bottom when the ruble crashed in 1998, wiping out the savings of millions. But by the early 2000s, Russia's oil reserves had fueled an economic recovery. Russia became much richer, but it also became much less equal. By the middle of this decade, the only city that had more billionaires than Moscow was New York. At the same time, 30% of all Russians were paid less than the minimum level for bare subsistence. But the re-emergence of a middle class meant a new audience for cinema, and the breakthrough year was 2004. On the international circuit, that was the year that Andrei Zvyagintsev's disturbing, slow-moving and metaphor-rich road movie The Return won the Golden Lion at the Venice Film Festival. But at home in Russia, the film that had them packing the aisles was a very different sort of high-speed extravaganza. Timur Bekmambetov directed A Tale of Wizards and Vampires. It was called Night Watch, and it swiftly became Russia's biggest ever box office hit, making over $16 million. The studio quickly cashed in with a sequel, Day Watch. One of the multitude who saw it was Natalie Ryabchikova, a graduate of Moscow's prestigious film school.
There is a battle there, and then windows start exploding, everything just blows up.
Towering above me here is the Cosmos Hotel, one of the biggest in Russia, indeed in the world. And this hotel had a rather spectacularly messy fate at the end of movie Daywatch, when wizards and vampires who've taken over Moscow somehow contrived to blow up the entire hotel, and actually most of the rest of Moscow along with it.
The hotel literally disappears, and a huge wave goes around Moscow,
vaporizing the buildings.
Basically, yeah.
Yes, the huge Ferris wheel, which is just placed a little way away from the hotel, it basically starts sort of rolling around.
Yeah, it rolls
comes
around,
off its moorings.
Damages cars, buildings, people run screaming.
I hear that some Russians outside Moscow are not always terribly fond of the capital city. Was there a little kind of thrill of pleasure, perhaps, for all those audiences across Russia seeing the capital city blown to smithereens?
Yeah, I think there was. I think the scene was actually staged this way to please or to appeal to provincial audiences, because it symbolizes this rich Moscow, this posh Moscow that many people really want to see blown away.
On the other side of Moscow, I met one of Russia's most influential young filmmakers, Alexei Papagrebsky. The cafe in the Mayakovsky Theatre, named after one of the Soviet Union's major playwrights, is where so many of the new generation of movie makers hang out.
Well, this is true. This is the favorite spot for new Russian cinema directors and actors to mingle. And as I say, metaphorically, if somebody decides to drop a bomb, at least half of new Russian cinema would be gone, for better or for worse.
Night Watch, whatever you think of the film, and it's both admired and disliked by different people, was a bit of a turning point. It was a film that brought Russian audiences, in a commercial sense, back to the movies. Is that right?
This is absolutely correct, because that was the breaking stone after which people thought, maybe it's not so bad to go watch a Russian film, because in terms of the return on their money, they were getting as many special effects on the square foot as from any other Hollywood blockbuster. Because people want to be entertained, they want to be impressed. Unlike Soviet times, when cinema, going to films, was the favorite pastime. It was one of the few opportunities to have a diversion or entertainment. And people were going to watch any film. They were going to watch a film about farm milkmaid, for example, or the tractor repairsman. Everything was watched. Now it's really for the younger middle class to go to a well-furnished, well-equipped cinema.
Like a multiplex.
A multiplex. And pay the almost the same money as in Europe to watch a film.
Is it possible to make a film that captures the huge audiences of Night Watch, but also deals with the more gritty realities of life in Russia today? If any place could do this, it would surely be Mosfilm. This legendary studio now uses all the latest technology, but it also gave birth to Soviet classics from Battleship Potemkin to Solaris. The 1990s was a lost decade. Rubbish gathered on the silent sound stages, and stray dogs were reputedly seen wandering around the sets. But today, Mosfilm is firing on all canisters. This is a film studio that's very much aware of its own history. One of the longest continuously running film studios in the world, actually.
It is.
I mean, we've got two quotes, even today, here in 2009. One from Sergei Eisenstein, you know, perhaps still Russia's greatest director, and one from Vladimir Lenin. Now, I mean, Lenin isn't a figure who you necessarily expect to see quoted, particularly on the arts today. Is it surprising to see a quote from him up there?
It's actually the most famous quote by Lenin about the cinema, that says cinema for us is the most important art. So this is the phrase that filmmakers in the Soviet Union have been using for years and years and years to justify their own, well, importance, sort of. The phrase lives on. Oh, here, see, there's a picture of Eisenstein.
That's on the set of Ivan the Terrible, presumably. Exactly. You can see Ivan himself there holding his hand up, and in front of him, a whole variety of cameramen and other stagehands. I've been finding out about Mosfilm's past, but the studio also has a very active present. And a lot of that happens right here on Moscow's biggest soundstage. And it's the size of a football pitch. This is a huge space on which to make the dreams that fuel today's Russian cinema come alive. Lights shining from every angle, from the ceiling, from the sides. You can see how, in the space of just a few hours, just a few days, all the props, the costumes, all of these can be brought together in this space to create one of the dozens of movies that are made here at Mosfilm every year. And perhaps those films are part of a wider sense of searching in Russia today, not least amongst Russia's younger people, a generation who've grown up without the certainties of the old Soviet ideology that, of course, brought Mosfilm into existence.
In Soviet period, we have idea. You can say it was bad idea, yes, okay. You can say it was good idea, somebody said, but it was idea.
Karan Shakhnazarov is a distinguished director who made his name during the Soviet era and is now head of Mosfilm.
Around this idea was the fight. Some life was around this. Somebody supported, and others not support those called dissidents. But I mean, this was the really big idea. Now it's vanished. And so we have, for my opinion, our society have no anything to live for. Because it's impossible to live just